We were more interested in what is the global north? Because the global south will come later. What is the global north? So this was an act of some analysis. Firstly, it was very obvious that we needed to look at the military. Now, it became clear when we looked at the statistics available by groups like SIPRI that they routinely deflate US military numbers. They deflate it because the United States military doesn't keep its entire military budget in the Department of Defense. A lot of the US military budget is in the Department of Energy, particularly atomic weapons. So how can you take the US Department of Defense numbers and assume that those numbers are US military spending, because you are not looking at the nuclear weapons, which are a key part of the United States military apparatus? So we did an audit of the 2022 US budget, and we came up with our own numbers, which are more accurate than the SIPRI numbers. SIPRI said somewhere around $900 billion was the US military spend. We found $1.53 trillion. That's a much more accurate number, in my opinion. And every year it's been going up. If you look again and audit all the major countries' weapons spending, military spending, the numbers were slightly different from SIPRI, but the biggest inaccuracy was the US numbers. What we found when we aggregated them, and I wrote to SIPRI and said, I invite you to have a discussion or a debate or whatever you'd like. Of course, they don't respond. It's very interesting to see who funds SIPRI and who operates it. I mean, it's a really good institute, but there are some blind spots which are important, I think, to discuss. And I wish they would take the time and bother to talk to us, but they don't need to. You know, they're super well more established. You know, why should they talk to us? Anyway, when we aggregated the NATO plus countries into one number, what we found was 74.3% of world military spending in 2022 was by the NATO plus countries, with the United States being by far the largest component of that entire amount, 74.3. Russian contribution to world military spending was 4% in comparison, Chinese 10%. If you aggregate Russia and China, which is actually inaccurate to do, it's 14%. That's a lot less than 74.3%. We also, when we looked at the military, thought, let's take a look at two other aspects. One, which we published about, one we haven't published, I don't know if we will. The one we published about was the military bases. Now, there's a number of calculations of military bases. World Without War, for instance, uses a number of 800 bases. That's about 20 years old. It was used by Chalmers Johnson, who's an important analyst of US military power. He had worked inside the US military apparatus till he broke with them in the 1990s, late 90s, and so on. He wrote a trilogy of books, very good books. He also used the number 900. But this number is, I think, out of date. I know it's out of date. The real number is 900 plus, maybe up to 990. But we came to 900, roughly 900 US military bases overseas. Now, for instance, do you add Exmouth to the list of US military bases? It's basically a communications and listening station. Is that a base? Well, we consider it a military facility. It should be added to US military bases, because whether it's a place with a lot of US troops or whether they look like civilians, like in Pine Gap, where they have the appearance of civilians, but they work for the National Security Agency, which is the world's largest spying agency. Are they part of the military or are they civilians? Is Pine Gap effectively a US military base, or is it an Australian facility with US advisors? These are the kind of debates and discussions we had. Now, obviously, for your generous Australian souls, you'll say, well, it's an Australian base because we have sovereignty over our country. And these are our guests that just live in a civilian place, Their children go to school there and so on. And, you know, they don't roam around in uniforms. Maybe there's a few people, but by and large, it's an Australian base because we're proud Australians. Exmouth, well, there's Australians also there. There might be more Americans, but there's Australia. I mean, the history of that facility is extraordinary. It was just commandeered by the United States. They first took it, and then they approached the Australian government and said, we think this is a good place to set up a communications station. I don't think, if you look at the record on it, it's not like the United States came to the Australian government and said, we would like to set up. They said, this is the best place. We want this. And there it is, regardless of the coral reefs, regardless of everything else. They just established themselves there. So if you look at the bases, it's really quite interesting. 400 U.S. military bases in the Pacific. That's extraordinary. I mean, it includes, of course, the bases in Hawaii and so on. But in Japan, you know, huge, huge military properties. Four new ones, maybe five, in the Philippines. Bases in, of course, Guam, in American Samoa, in the Marshall Islands, everywhere you look. You know, and the history of nuclear testing in that region, really unremarked today. People don't talk about the Bikini Atoll and how much that island was hammered. And where the people from there now live, it's an extraordinary story of complete disregard for the communities of the Pacific. No wonder the Kanak resistance movement in New Caledonia wants to join the people of Senegal to tell the French to go home. And I think in a few years, we're going to see rumblings in Guam, American Samoa, and so on. I mean, right now, you don't have the rumblings because the populations there see a path for employment by joining the US military. There is a high school, and the biggest employer out of that high school would be the US military. There's a pathway, but I don't think that's going to last forever. I think the example of the Kanaks, the example of the Solomon Islands is going to start being contagious across the Pacific world. 400 bases just in the Pacific, 11 aircraft carriers just in the Pacific. It is really interesting that Australia has a navy, because you're defending yourself against all the invaders that are coming to take over your land, which of course most of you have taken over from people anyway, but let's forget about that. That shouldn't be remarked upon. Let's start the story with your land here. You have a navy that's patrolling the China seas to protect the sea lanes which bring goods to Australia and take Australian goods to China. So the logic of that patrol, which is highly provocative, is to ensure that the Chinese vessels continue to come through lanes which China might threaten. I mean, even saying it like that is confusing. Like, the whole thing is confusing. 900 military bases. The Chinese, by the way, no military bases. There's one base that people point to in Djibouti, which is in the Horn of Africa. I've been to that base. It's adjacent to the US base. What is the Chinese base in Djibouti? The Chinese base in Djibouti was set up so the Chinese could send their ships there to assist the UN mission against piracy in the Red Sea. Now, I am completely opposed to the UN mission against piracy, because rather than protecting the small fishermen from the big giant trawlers that come from other parts of the world, and instead of helping those fishermen recover their waters, those fishermen have become pirates against the big ships, the UN is actually going after the small fishermen. Super against that mission. But whether you are for or against that mission, that base is not an overseas base for Chinese expansion. Like, that is just not accurate. Like, I would like that base to be closed down because I want that mission to be shut down. That doesn't mean it's an overseas base for Chinese power projection. The 900 bases, on the other hand, are bases for power protection, including the base that I very much was shocked to see in terms of its size, which is the US drone base in Agadez in Niger, just south of the Sahara. It is the largest drone base in the world. You can ask me later, why does the United States have a massive drone base in Niger, which until now the government of Niger hasn't asked them to vacate, but that might come. We shall see. And that's another thought. So the military exercise of looking at spending and so on, and then looking at the NATO charter closely, reading the Treaty of San Francisco, reading the AUKUS Treaty and so on, it becomes very clear that the Global North operates as a military bloc. It is in fact a military bloc. It operates together. Secondly, it operates as a diplomatic and political bloc. Now, obviously, diplomatic and political things are much less coherent than something like NATO, because NATO's charter says that if one of us is attacked, then all of us have to defend that country, similar to the Treaty of San Francisco. These are much more binding treaties, whereas G7 and some of the other political and diplomatic agreements are not binding. So in the last vote on Cuba, the Global North didn't vote to defend the United States in its ridiculous blockade against Cuba. Most countries of the world, 187, voted against that blockade. There's no treaty obligation to vote together. But every year, the heads of government, the foreign ministers and so on meet at the G7 meeting, and they lay out a strategic outlook. I looked at the G7 meeting in 1974, 84 and 94, these three, just to look to see what they were like, the internal discussions. They are all available at the different presidents' libraries. So the Gerald Ford Library has a 1974 transcript of discussions. You can actually read what they're talking about. That's one of the great things about the United States, is that actually some documents are available. Like you can read most of the declassified CIA documents online. That is actually quite interesting. That's one of the interesting features of the contradictions in the United States. You can read about their coups openly. They tell you. It's right here. In Washington Bullets, the book you mentioned, I use CIA materials. I interviewed CIA agents, including the station chief in Paris, the head of operations in Iran. They talked to me totally freely. And they talked about assassinations completely freely. Partly it's because they also operate on the assumption that everything is in the past. They don't do it now. That's an amazing amnesia. And the second assumption that they operate with is, look what we can do to you. They want you to know that they can do this. It's like a message that's there for people. We can coup you. This is how we did it. They're not afraid. It's like what Chomsky calls the gangster. The United States is the mafia, the gangster. If you don't agree with us, we'll just whack you. It's a perfectly good operating principle of power. If you don't agree with us, we'll whack you. We'll sanction you, we'll kill you, we'll overthrow your government, etc. Be careful, because we've done it before. What happened to Arbenz, it could happen to you. That's the advertisement from the CIA when it declassifies documents. So we shouldn't also think, wow, they're so open-minded, they declassify documents. They declassify them because they don't care. They operate as a military bloc. They operate as a political and diplomatic bloc. That's for sure. They also operate as an intelligence bloc. I mean, you know, Australia, New Zealand, these countries are not part of the Five Eyes, and now the 11 Eyes for nothing. This country, for instance, has provided, just if we do a little history lesson, this country has provided intelligence for the United States right through after World War II. It has in fact provided military assistance right through after World War II. In the Korean War, when the US bombers were bombing dams, Australian planes flew alongside them as protection for the US bombers. Very interesting, because after World War II, a Nazi officer who had flooded the dikes in Netherlands was hanged as a war criminal. But when the US bombers smashed the dams in the northern part of Korea with Australian air support, nobody was tried for a war crime. And then, of course, Australian troops went to Vietnam and fought brutally against the Vietnamese people joining the United States. Intelligence, including the bombing of Yemen recently and so on. It's a long list of you know, acts of war crimes, criminal intent by this country, even though so far away from the rest of the world. I remember writing my book, Darker Nations, and being pretty horrified to learn that the Australian military and intelligence services was telexing names of Indonesians to the Indonesian military to slaughter the people on those lists. That's not, I don't know what that is. I don't think anybody was ever brought to account for that. You know, and they have the names of the people on those documents. Jeffrey Robinson wrote about it in his book on Bali, The Other Side of Paradise. You know, they had names of people who were telexing this stuff to the Indonesian authorities. They massacred 1 million communists in a matter of just weeks. You know, brutal, you know, participation in that, you know, politicide of the left in Indonesia. Well, so the global north acts as a bloc, and we have ample evidence of it. You know, on the case of the Palestinians, it's rock solid. You know, they're all in a phalanx. There's minor differences here and there, some criticism, some here and there, but not really. They operate rock solid as a bloc.